Oceana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good! Villanova wins it!
He tied, it is a touchdown! New England wins!
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row!
Miles Boykin is in the end zone! The Irish have come back!
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to Sports Beat from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. We're also brought to you by Goshen Heart and Vascular. Be the hero your heart deserves. Visit GoshenHeartAndVascular.org. And by Blackthorn Golf Club and the Blackthorn Cart. Only $99. Get it at Blackthorn, and then you can save up to 80% off rounds of golf. That includes cart at Blackthorn Golf Club in South Bend. The owner is Tim Firestone, one of my co-hosts on the golf show every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. here on WSBT. My name is Darren Pritchett, WSBT Radio Sports Director, coming to you from Midland, Michigan at Dow Diamond, the home of the Great Lakes Loons. Tonight, the Loons and the South Bend Cubs begin a three-game series, and it's a very short road trip for South Bend. We are back at Four Winds Field on Friday to open up a six-game homestand against Lake County and Fort Wayne. South Bend coming off a 5-3 homestand, losing yesterday to West Michigan 6-2. More on South Bend coming up in just a little bit. Coming up this hour on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, we'll spend a little time talking about Irish junior cornerback Julian Love. Could this be an All-American season for the talented Irish defensive back? Also, a little information on Luke Deal, the outstanding tight end who verbally committed to Auburn over the weekend. He was also thinking about Notre Dame and Clemson, so we'll evaluate the tight end position in the recruiting process for the Fighting Irish. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to talk about first memories of sports, the first time we remember seeing a sporting event in person, watching on TV, and maybe what event was the most impactful event that you first saw in person or on television. My five question of the day, Eric's five favorite college football coaches that he has covered. Then next hour, we'll let Sean chime in on the first memories of sports. We'll talk about the Indy 500, Anthony Rizzo's slide yesterday in the Pirate game. Replay got involved. They ruled that everything was okay with Rizzo sliding to home plate where he took the legs out from under the catcher who was in a defenseless position. But, aha, today, according to ESPN, sources tell them that Major League Baseball has told the Cubs and the Pirates they got it wrong yesterday and that Rizzo's slide was illegal. We'll talk all about that coming up next hour. We'll have rapid fire and a whole lot more on this installment of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. That Cub game, Chicago won 7-0, so that play just made the margin greater than it should have been, but it was a classic four-sided home plate. And in the old days of baseball where Rizzo just took out the catcher's legs, that would have been just perfectly fine. But now everyone is trying to be protected on the base pass as a defensive player. And it was a spot where the catcher was on the plate, made the catch, and then moved out in front of home plate to throw down to first base. And Rizzo lifted the front leg just enough. He took it off the ground to upend the catcher, and that led to the catcher, Diaz, lobbing the ball way over the head of the play at first base. And again, replay got involved. They got it wrong yesterday. So that play should have been ruled differently. It was an illegal slide by Rizzo. And the Pirates still lost the game. Really doesn't matter in the whole scheme of things. But I have not had a chance to listen to the audio. But I think Rizzo is shocked that that is an illegal slide. And Eric, I don't know if you saw it or not. Eric Hansen now joining me, the Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune. But when I saw it happen, I thought it was an illegal slide with today's rules. It was, I wouldn't call it a dirty slide. I think it was unnecessary. I don't think that makes it dirty. And with just all the changes in baseball, we're trying to keep the best players on the field. It does no one any good to have superstars get injured and be out for a couple of months. Prime example, a couple of years ago, Buster Posey, the catcher of the Giants, was taken out and suffered a serious knee injury. That led to all the changes in Major League Baseball.
I did not see it, and I fully, wholeheartedly endorse your view on it.
Thank you. I appreciate your vote. We'll see you in November. All right. I want to let you know that coming up on tomorrow's program, an interview I'm really looking forward to, Mike Rooney is going to join us, a Notre Dame baseball player from 88 to 92. He spent time at Arizona State on Pat Murphy's coaching staff, and now he is the lead voice of ESPN's coverage of the NCAA baseball tournament, including the College World Series. He's going to join us tomorrow at 5:30 to talk about the NCAA tournament. And we'll also touch on something that Eric and I talked about briefly the other day. What should be the standard now for Notre Dame baseball? What should they strive to be each and every year? They're in a very difficult conference. It's not easy being a northern school in the ACC. There are a lot of disadvantages. So what should be the standard, I guess, we hold Notre Dame baseball to each and every year? So we'll ask Mike about that coming up on tomorrow's program. And to make a long, boring story short, I think it was 3 years ago, if not 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I'm sitting in a hotel in Massachusetts with the Notre Dame hockey team. We're getting set to take on Merrimack. I'm watching a Notre Dame basketball game in the lounge as I eat, and I was talking to someone, and Mike was sitting a table over, and he stopped me and said, "Your voice sounds very familiar. Can I ask who you are?" And I told him. He goes, "Well, I listen to your show online all the time. I'm Mike Rooney. I'm a Notre Dame grad. I'm really into Notre Dame football and this and that." So he listened to the show online. He heard my voice in the lounge, introduced himself. So I've got a chance to know him a little bit. So this is the first time we'll have him on the program tomorrow, as he is going to have a lot of fun over the next few weeks leading up to the conclusion of the College World Series. You talk about, of all the places in the world I could meet somebody, I didn't expect it to be in Merrimack College's town. I think is it Andover, Massachusetts, if I remember right? So I guess one of those small world stories. All right, so Mike's going to join us tomorrow at 5:30 here on WSBT Radio. All right, Eric, let's talk about several subjects. We'll begin with Julian Love, the Notre Dame junior cornerback, set a Notre Dame record for pass breakups in a season last year, had the great game against Michigan State. He jumped a route, took it to the house for a touchdown, helping the Irish take down Michigan State in East Lansing in a big early season victory for the Fighting Irish. That was, I believe, coming off the Georgia loss, and that was a big, big boost for the Irish football team. And that was a great day for quarterback Brandon Wimbush against Michigan State. So, Eric, as you take a look at Julian Love's skill set, what gives him the opportunity to be great?
Well, he's got a little bit of everything, including really good instincts and the ability to really play all three corner positions. He can play the boundary, he can play the field, has the physicality to play the boundary, has the speed to play the field, and he can line up with a slot receiver and play inside if you really needed him to. And then he could play safety for you. He's really, really good against the service academies and the triple option. So there's so much to his game. And what he did last year during the season is something he didn't do in the springtime, and that was bring a really elite-level focus to his game. In the spring, Todd Light was a little bit critical and felt like there were times he coasted a little bit in the spring. I don't think we'll see that in the fall. But, you know, when you look at Julian, you kind of start and say, where can you pick on him? What are his weaknesses? And, you know, He's got enough length. He's got certainly enough speed. He's very, very smart, has really good ball skills. You kind of wonder where the weakness is, because if it exists, I haven't discovered it yet.
Well, you mentioned he can play all three cornerback spots, and we could also add in he could play safety, because he has done that against triple option teams. And we had how many conversations from after the end of the 2017 season up until the start of the 2000 I should say 2016 leading up to the 2017 season. How many times do we talk about Julian Love maybe should be playing safety because of the lack of bodies at that spot?
Well, and let's throw in his tackling ability. A lot of times you don't want a cornerback to be high on your team in tackles because it means people are catching the ball and then running with it and then him getting the tackle. That wasn't the case with Julian Love. Between his interceptions and his pass breakups, that's 23 passes defended. Mm. Nobody else on the team was even in double figures. So he is defending the passes. So it's not that people are catching him and then he's tackling them. When you look at his solo tackles, there was only one person on the team that had more solos than Julian Love, and that was Tavon Coney.
Wow. So when you think about Julian Love coming into his junior campaign, Eric, what do you think the chances are that this will be his final season at Notre Dame? And if you think it will be, what do you think will have taken place for him to take that shot at the NFL draft a year early?
Well, he does need to bring more consistency than he did in the spring. He was good in the spring. I think they expected him to be great in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was Troy Pride and Sean Crawford were great in the spring. Now, that doesn't mean Julian Love is going to be sitting, but I think with those other really good corners, he's going to raise his level. So what would have to happen? He would have to have a year statistically similar to last year and do it in the big games too, which he has. I mean, Michigan State was a big game at the time, and he came through with flying colors in that game. The defense was outstanding in terms of big plays and takeaways and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, statistically, he was near the top in a lot of categories last year. He didn't get the recognition, I think, because Notre Dame safeties kind of held the corners back and held the overall defense back. I don't think that's going to be the case this year. I think the safeties are going to be at least a neutral thing instead of a pull on the defense. And then he would have a decision to make in coming out and just based on where he would get drafted. He's not in a position, I think, where A, his family needs him mm-hmm. to come out early, or B, he's doesn't enjoy school and doesn't do well with it and just wants to get out and not go to class anymore. I think Julian, for him to come out, would have to be at least a second-round pick to want to come out. Equanimeous was going to come out no matter what round he was going to go in. He and Josh Adams didn't matter what round, and as it turned out, they didn't go very high. But a lot of guys make the calculation based on where they would go. So Julian, I would think, would have to be in a second-round role for that to happen.
Eric, do you see early on in the season teams trying to avoid Julian Love and maybe try to see what Troy Pride Jr. or the nickel has in store for them? I mean, is this a spot where Love has gained enough respect where teams may back off a little bit?
Well, it's hard because Troy Pride and Sean Crawford are surging. I think if I'm an offensive coordinator, I want to somehow get Sean Crawford lined up against a tall receiver and try to throw 50-50 balls. Other than that, I think it's those other two have improved so much that not only did it kind of chase Nick Watkins off the roster, it's going to make it very difficult to pick your poison. What I would want to do is somehow get a safety in one-on-one coverage and try to see what I could get there. And I probably would try Troy Pride at first over Julian Love, but I have a feeling that that's going to tend to be a mistake. You know, last year when the year started, Darren, people thought Nick Watkins was the more elite corner, mm-hmm. and they were going after Julian Love. And after about 3 weeks, they were like, okay, this isn't happening. And then they went after Nick Watkins with a little bit of success, and that's when Troy Pride kind of surged into the picture. So it was interesting that the perception was Nick Watkins was the guy not to throw at, and they went after Julian Love, which was bad. That's the problem if you're an opposing offensive coordinator, is just that there's such quality at those corners, and then you kind of have Dante Vaughn rotating in, another pretty good corner.
Eric Hansen, Fighting Irish Football Insider for the South Bend Tribune. I'm Darren Pritchett, 20 minutes after the top of the hour, Sports Beat on WSBT Radio. Some news over the weekend. Luke Deal, nation's top tight end, picked Auburn over Notre Dame and Clemson. So Luke Deal not picking Notre Dame, is it a big deal?
I think they certainly would have loved to have him. You know, there are limited options in terms of tight ends that are still left on the board, but there's enough of them that are good that Notre Dame can make a run at some of these guys. I think they'd like to get a tight end in this class, and they don't want to just take a guy. I know that in the 2020 class, they are involved with some of the top guys there, and I think that seems like more the time where they're going to be able to get that elite, you know, right out of the box kind of tight end like Cole Kmet and Brock Wright kind of are. But I think it would have been nice to have him. I think it would have also been a little bit of a luxury. And again, you got to be realistic. Some kids want to get on the field.
Sure.
And would Luke Deal have gotten on the field next year at Notre Dame? Probably, but he wouldn't have been probably the one or two option either.
So, Eric, when you think about how the tight end position at Notre Dame right now is more on the youthful side, even though a guy like Nick Wisher is going to be leaving the program after this year, you've got a lot of young guys in key spots.
Alizé probably, too.
Exactly. So when you look at the roster right now, is it hard for Notre Dame to acquire an elite tight end in this class, knowing how there's a few guys on this roster that might be here for a couple of more years?
It's a little bit harder sell because those elite tight ends want to get on the field right away. The top guy that's already visited Notre Dame that's still on the board is a kid named Jude Wolf. He's from Bellflower, St. Joe Bosco in California. And again, he's got a lot of other top teams chasing him. And then there are other guys that they can certainly get involved with that haven't visited. But Jude Wolf would be kind of the number one target right now. I just think that's kind of the nature of a lot of positions is that, you know, some kids, it doesn't matter who's on the depth chart because they think they're better. And there are other kids that kind of want guaranteed playing time without you telling them that it's guaranteed. And they look at your depth chart and they see that Cole Kmet and Brock Wright are going to be sophomores. And they figure, okay, that's at least two seasons that those guys are going to be there. I think that's where it gets a little bit more ticklish. I think in the 2020 class, you're thinking, okay, it would be great to learn behind those great guys, and then someday I'm going to be the man. And I think that's kind of why Notre Dame might have a little bit of trouble in that area, because certainly your offensive coordinator is your tight ends coach. That's a great selling point if you're tight end right now.
Well, Chip's got to be very happy right now when he walks into that tight end room. Eric, there's a ton of talent and a lot of guys that can do different things. So, yeah, you look at a guy like Luke Deal, he wants to play right away. I don't blame him. You're the best tight end in the country. If all these people are right, heck, I'd want to play right away too. And it's awfully hard to bypass some pretty good players on the depth chart right now at Notre Dame.
Correct. And sometimes geography plays into it. I believe Deal was from South Carolina. He stayed south. He didn't pick Clemson, but he did pick Auburn. And, you know, sometimes that's kind of in your wheelhouse. And there's other kids that can get over that. Nana Asafu-Mensa, the defensive end from Fort Worth, Texas, that just picked Notre Dame about a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was concerned about the cold. And finally, in his mind, he got over that. But that was kind of a big deal in terms of whether this was going to happen for Notre Dame or not. And in the end, he said, I can live with, you know, the cold weather for, you know, who knows how long. Because if he plays in the NFL, he's going to have to deal with cold weather, at least on his road games sometimes.
Well, Alizé Mack has a lot to prove this year. And I'm sure he is extra motivated to be the best he can be this year. Because Cole Kmet and Brock Wright, even though they had small roles last year, I'm sure they are really ready to roll to take on a bigger opportunity in this offense. And if Alizé does not get off to a great start, Eric, anything's possible. When you have good depth, a lot of time coaches aren't going to forget about you, but at the same time, you might get passed along if things don't get moving briskly early on in this season, especially at the tight end position.
Yeah, you know, Cole Kmet had a really, really good spring, and that was with playing baseball on top of it. Brock Wright was injured for about two-thirds of the spring, but once he was able to take the red jersey off, we saw quite a bit from Brock Wright. So there are two really good options there. Nick Wisher presumably is going to be healthy. He wasn't able to participate in contact. And Nick, we know, at least can catch the ball. Yeah. And I don't know that he's that much behind Alizé in terms of blocking, but Alizé still has a skill in terms of his speed that would be wonderful to get him on the field and be a consistent player, but we'll see. Then I'd say of the two true freshmen, Tommy Tremble and George Takis, you know, George at 6'6", 245 had the edge by being an early enrollee. The problem was George was injured, so he didn't get to participate in spring practice. And I don't know how much of Matt Bayless's work he was able to get in. So I'm not sure that Tommy Tremble is behind him. The other thing is Tommy is a different kind of tight end. 6'3", 224, was injured during his senior high school season. Be interesting to see what kind of weight he's able to put on, but he is definitely a split tight end. He's a detached tight end. So he kind of gives you something a little bit different. So of those two, I think Tommy Tremble probably has the better chance to play just because of the different skill set.
And Cole Kmet, his Notre Dame baseball freshman campaign wrapped up recently. 26 appearances, one start. He ended up with a 5.05 ERA, 2-5 the record, 46 and a third innings, 50 hits. He walked 25, struck out 39. The opposition hit 279 against him. And I wonder, Eric, you know, I did not get a chance to see Cole in person this year. I wonder if he just kind of wore down after a long college baseball season. Coming from high school to college, obviously it's a big, big difference because his numbers were spectacular over the first, gosh, I would say, what, 2 months of the year?
Yeah, and he was doing it against top 10 teams, too. His first save came against an LSU team that was ranked in the top 10 at the time. It's going to be interesting. I have to go back and chart against all the teams that he pitched against that made the NCAA tournament, but he definitely did not have the snap that he had early in the season. And between football and baseball and school, I think maybe got worn down a little bit. But I think it's something that now that he's got a year under his belt, he can prepare and be better for. He pitched a lot more innings than Smarja did his first time through as a pitcher. He logged a lot of innings, both as a reliever and just, you figure, just that one start. But they would use him for four innings sometimes as a reliever. So he logged a lot of innings, and I think that he is very serious about his baseball future. So next year I think will be a critical year for him as far as baseball. But football talent is certainly there. But he's talked to Jeff Smarja. I'm not sure that if there is a pro baseball future, I'm not so sure he wouldn't pick that ultimately, but it's so early to kind of determine that.
Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett, Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on WSBT Radio. That's some Notre Dame football conversation. Coming up in just a couple of moments, we'll do something a little different. We'll talk about early sports memories going back to our childhood. What are some of the events that still stick with us today? We'll talk about that. We got a My 5 question of the day coming up in about 20 minutes. Eric has covered college football for a good amount of time. He's covered a lot of coaches. So who are the five coaches more than anybody else he has enjoyed covering? So we'll get to that list coming up in a couple of moments as Sports Beat continues on 96.1 WBT, the sports leader. Sports Beat continues, brought to you by Budweiser, Goshen Heart and Vascular, and Blackthorn Golf Club and the Blackthorn Card. I'm WSBT Radio Sports Director Darren Pritchett with the South Bend Cubs in Midland, Michigan. First pitch tonight at 7:05, pregame at 6:50. Eric Hansen back in our WSBT studios. He is the Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune. going to do a segment on first sports memories. Maybe you have some memories as a kid that stand out to you. The first big sporting event you went to. Maybe a special event that was on TV that has stuck with you after all these years. So, Eric, let me start with you. What's the first sporting event that you remember seeing in person?
Well, there were a few kind of clogged together that I remember going, all of them actually going with my dad too. One was a Columbus Owls minor league hockey game. They were in the International League. And I just, what struck me was the language of the people around us, because my dad was a big dude. He was 6'4" and pretty built. And he would give them the stink eye, and then they would kind of tone it down a little bit. Cincinnati Reds sitting really high up, and I can't tell you which teams it was before the Big Red Machine teams, but I remember just sitting really high and thinking my dad did not have the connections that I thought he did. And then the last one was my first Ohio State football game. I remember it. I can't tell you the year. I remember it being against Minnesota, and I was thrilled because my dad got us seats in the very first row. I was thrilled until the players came onto the field and were standing in front of us for the whole game. But it was still fun to be in the stadium and fun to be with my dad for those games. So it wasn't like, you know, I saw a no-hitter or something crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
How big is the horseshoe? How many fans fit in there?
It's over 100,000 and pushing 110 now. At that time, it was about 89, 90, because the horseshoe had an open end then, and that part of the stadium has been where most of the growth has been in terms of additional seats.
I'm just thinking, as a youngster, that's got to be overwhelming going to a stadium like that for one of your first events.
Well, it was, certainly many more people there than at
the Columbus Owls.
Yeah, the Columbus Owls, or even the Cincinnati Reds, which was in Riverfront Stadium. But that was a new stadium. It was a really neat experience. But, yeah, the Ohio State football stadium and the traffic and everything. But I just loved football so much that it didn't worry me. And my dad always kind of made me feel protected, so I didn't feel like anything would happen to me. So I wasn't scared. I was just scared of bad seats, and that was my only fear.
Or Michigan fans sitting around you. That would make you very, very scared. You know, for me, the first event I remember seeing in person, I have the scorecard still somewhere, but for some reason I just kind of remember the players running around and stuff. But it was 1978, so I would have been six. I would turn seven later that year. But we went to a Los Angeles Dodgers-St. Louis Cardinals game at the old Busch Stadium. And we weren't necessarily sitting that close, but I just remember at that point I was collecting kind of baseball cards. Every Friday, if I was good, I got baseball cards at the drugstore. So I'd started collecting. And for whatever reason, one of my favorite Cardinals a few years earlier was Reggie Smith, who I'm sure you remember.
Yeah.
Very well. He was playing for the Dodgers at that time, so I think I remember being kind of confused. Why is my guy playing for the other team now? So that was a little odd, but that ended up being a heck of a Dodger team. That was the era where it was Dodgers-Yankees, you know, several times. So that would have been Steve Yeager and that bunch. I don't think Steve Sachs would have been there yet in 78. He would have been there when they went in 81, if I'm not mistaken. Probably Dusty Baker was playing left field. Reggie Smith was out there. I would assume Say and Russell would have been there by now. Maybe Davey Lopes as well. So that was a pretty good Dodger team back in the day. So that's the first real event I remember seeing in person. What about the first event you remember watching on television?
Well, it wasn't that big of a deal. It was Ohio State basketball games. I was playing basketball, and rather poorly, as an elementary school student, and I started playing organized basketball in the second grade. So me and this kid named Billy Knoll, you know, when we'd stay overnight at each other's house, we would watch the Ohio State basketball games and kind of talk about how we would help the team if we were out there. And there was this guy named Jimmy Crum that was the announcer. He was a local You know, and you can insert your own joke, but Jimmy Crum, anything that was within 10 points was a barn burner. I do remember that. But it wasn't, again, for me, it wasn't like this, you know, great ideal epitome moment. The thing that I didn't get to see a lot of that I wanted to, I was a big Cardinals fan because of Bob Gibson, and I didn't get to see many of their games on television, and I wished that I had seen more of that. And I wanted my parents to take me to St. Louis to meet him. Not only did I want to go to the game, I wanted to meet him because I was so impressed with him from a book he wrote called From Ghetto to Glory, which was my first A ever on a book report. So that never happened. But anytime I could have seen Bob Gibson on television, it was very, very special.
Boy, I tell you what, my internship in college was with a production company in St. Louis, and we had an event where we had to be around Bob Gibson, and I got to shake his hand and meet him, Eric, and I've never been more scared in my life. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
After all those years of how intimidating he was on the baseball field, and maybe that's why I was intimidated hearing the stories about him, but I was really, really nervous when I shook his hand. There's just something about his presence that just made it feel like not your normal meeting somebody on the street. And again, I think it had a lot to do with just watching the video and hearing stories about how tough and intimidating he was. I don't know if I have ever been that nervous. In fact, I can tell you, I've never been that nervous in meeting someone than meeting Bob Gibson. So I hope someday you get to meet him because, you know, he's kind of a quiet guy. He didn't have a whole lot to say. He was very polite. He said hello and everything, but he is just one of those individuals you'd want on your side if you're playing baseball. You would not want him on the other side. It would not be a very comfortable day in the batter's box, especially if you did something good against him. And guys like Gibson and Nolan Ryan, if they played today, they'd pull their hair out.
Well, I'll tell you, he had, I remember, he was the reason that they lowered the pitching mound. He had a 1.12 ERA one season and a big, long winning streak. And I bought, after I got that A on the book report, I bought a book, Bob Gibson Had a Pitch Book. And he was great at being explained. He believed that you should be a good fielding pitcher, and you should be able to manage the base runners at first base, and you should be a good hitting pitcher. And so for me, you know, again, I think because I was such a little kid, I had stars in my eyes. I wasn't intimidated by him, and maybe if I met him in person, I would have been. But he was who I wanted to be. You know, he was this guy that explained everything and was really strong on the inside, and it made me just really admire him. And so I didn't get that sense, but probably if I saw how tall and big and strong he was in person, I would have melted and been scared. But he is just somebody that I just thought, wow, I want to grow up and be like him.
Yeah, Stan Musial, Lou Brock were absolutely so awesome to be around. They were just special, just like you would expect after watching them on TV. But Gibby had that factor that just scared the daylights out of you, even after all these years. And from my standpoint, the first event I remember watching on TV, for some reason, I just have these little visions of the Cowboys-Broncos Super Bowl, in which Denver turned it over like 25 times. It felt like, I think the total was 9 that day, and Randy White and Harvey Martin, if I remember right.
How many was it?
I think it was 9 that day, really. If it was nine it was 8. Yeah, exactly right. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. 9 times. I didn't realize what I was saying. Okay. So I do remember the orange jerseys kind of running around a little bit. I remember Steelers-Cowboys, a Super Bowl, but that's kind of the first recollections that I have. So how about this? What event was the first event that was the most impactful to you, whether it be in person or on TV?
I think the Dallas Cowboys winning the Super Bowl with Tom Landry. And I would have, I don't know how old I would have been, maybe 10 at that time, and beating the Dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, and I remember writing to the Cowboys and asking for a team picture, and they sent one to me.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Were you a Cowboys fan, or you just wanted one?
I like Tom Landry, and I was trying to figure out who I liked in football, and I ended up gravitating to the Falcons eventually, but there was something about the Cowboys in that era that was kind of appealing to me. You know, the Browns weren't very good at the time, and nor were they ever. Right. And the Bengals were kind of an expansion team, and they didn't have the cool helmets yet. It just said, it was orange. It said Bengals on the side. It was a Browns helmet with the word Bengals on the side.
I remember that.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I was just kind of finding my way. You know, nothing. I figured Ohio State could beat the Dallas Cowboys, but I figured the Dallas Cowboys were the next best team.
You know, for me, the one thing I remember was 82, watching Game 7 of the World Series with my dad, who was a huge Cardinal fan, and they beat the Brewers. But the most impactful for me, and again, it's kind of affected my career, was just being someone that grew up in Central Illinois. I was 9 years old, didn't know anything about hockey, but getting all excited about the USA-Soviet Union Lake Placid game in 1980. Mm-hmm. I didn't really understand the rules. I didn't understand this offside and this icing. I knew you had to put it in the net. That was a good thing. You got a run or a whatever you call it. I didn't know at that time. But I just remember all the fans chanting USA, USA. And, you know, when you're 8, you don't understand the world political aspect of what was going on between the Soviet Union and the United States and all the things that were going on in our country. That was a downer with just a recession, high gas prices. So I didn't understand all that. I just knew that all these fans kept chanting USA, and I started chanting USA as a kid in front of my TV. And little did I know, Eric, the game wasn't even live. That was taped that day. At this point, we have no internet, we have no Twitter, we have no way of finding out the final score. So I thought I was watching something live when, in fact, it had occurred, I think, 3 hours earlier in Lake Placid. But that was my first taste of hockey, and the rest is history.
That's awesome. I remember that game, too. It was not anywhere near my first any kind, but I remember the excitement. And I did like the Olympics a lot. You know, my dad was foreign born, so we got into the Winter Olympics way more than most families. I do prefer the Summer Olympics now, but as a kid, you know, watching the ski jumping, watching the U.S. hockey, I mean, I wasn't a kid then. I was 20. Or 19 at that time, but I still was really interested in all those things except for figure skating. I was never, except the good-looking girl figure skater sometimes, Peggy Fleming.
Well, you probably weren't listening to the East Germans at that time. But anyway.
The evil East German judge.
Anyway, what I was going to ask, just that hockey game really got me kind of interested in hockey, which when I got into broadcasting a couple of years later as a kid, you know, that was the first time I thought, well, it'd be kind of cool to be a hockey announcer. No one around me wants to be a hockey announcer. Everybody likes baseball and football and basketball around me. No one in my hometown liked hockey or knew what it was. So how about you? Was there anything that you saw from a fan standpoint that got you interested in wanting to be a writer?
Oh, gosh, no. Because I didn't want to do that until I was a sophomore in college. I was a business major. I liked sports. I had an eighth grade English teacher that told me that I'd never amount to anything in terms of writing, that
wow.
I'd always be a C student in English.
Did she really?
Yeah, yep, she absolutely did. But I had an amazing 10th grade English teacher that changed all that, and her name is Vicki Bishop, and if she's ever listening, I owe you a dozen roses, if not more. So,
well, I made a half-court shot in 7th grade. I got into the game with 3 seconds left. I stole the ball, made a half-court shot in the locker room. The coach told me, great shot, but you'll never be in the game with the game on the line to hit a shot like that again. I gave up basketball and decided to be a PA announcer to get ready for a broadcasting career. Isn't that pathetic? For a coach to say something like that?
That is. But sometimes, you know, it works out for the best.
Yeah,
it works out. For me, it didn't discourage me. I thought, you know, she's probably right. And then I had some amazing teachers that certainly changed that. But I kind of fell into this by accident. Wasn't looking to do it. But I'll tell you what, when I tried it, it was like trying barbecued ribs for the first time. It was love.
Oh, I thought you were saying it was messy.
Yeah. Well, it was probably messy from what they had to edit to clean up, but it was love.
Eric and Darren with you. We'll do the My 5 question of the day next from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
One question, five answers. This is the My 5 question of the day on Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
The South Bend Tribune's Eric Hansen answers today's question. His five favorite college football coaches that he has covered. We begin with number five.
Yeah, I had to disqualify a couple people. Brian Kelly, because I'm still covering him. Lou Holtz, Bo Schembechler, Gary Moeller, George Perlis, just because they were kind of peripheral and not guys that I covered every day. So number five, I'm going with Tyrone Willingham. And I think that people got to see the boring side of Tyrone. But when you turned the microphone and the cameras off, the guy was fascinating. And I would love to live next door to him because of the kind of person he is. And he'd have a lot of cool stuff I could borrow, like nice tools.
Number four.
Jim Coletto, he was all over the place. Probably never should have been a head coach, but he was a guy that knew a lot about football and cared a lot about kids. I think if he had just stayed an offensive line coach like Harry Hiestand, he would have had a better career path. But fascinating guy, and it was very interesting to see him struggle in the spotlight as a head coach, but a guy that knew a lot about football.
Eric's five favorite college football coaches that he has covered, number three.
Well, Fred Akers. Fred had to follow a legend in Texas and then ended up getting fired. And Texas went through a lot of head coaches before they got Mack Brown, and Texas was rolling again. But when he moved up to Purdue, it was just interesting to see how he adapted. You know, he would try to still recruit Texas because that's where his connections were. And we had a function over at his house once, and I'm driving up, and in the front yard were three Longhorn steers. And so when I got inside the house, I said, "Fred, is that dinner?" And he goes, "Oh, my gosh, no." He goes, "Those are my pets."
Number two.
Number two, and I think this will surprise a lot of people, it's Charlie Weiss. Charlie was fascinating because he wanted to control everything, and he just couldn't. But his football knowledge paired with sometimes uneven people skills, it was really interesting to kind of see that blossom and implode, and then what he did after Notre Dame. Just a really interesting guy. But I think that there's a part of Charlie Weiss that is a really, really good person that people never got to know.
Yeah. And finally, more than anybody else, your favorite college football coach that you have covered on a consistent basis.
Well, he just passed away very recently, and that was Bill Mallory. And he was much different than I anticipated. I had remembered seeing him when he was at Colorado thinking, oh, my God, this guy is going to be boring. And he was nothing but. I got to watch a football program being built from the ground up, and I mean from ashes up. And just the integrity with everything he did, just being able to outwork people, outsmart people, just an amazing human being. So Bill Mallory's my number one guy.
That's the My 5 question from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
Here's Eric Hansen with what's coming up in tomorrow's South Bend Tribune sports section.
Tom Noy has a column on Brad Bass. He's a former Notre Dame pitcher, now a Detroit Tigers prospect. Pitches for West Michigan. Lots of softball regionals, St. Joseph, Penn, Bremen, and much, much more.
Eric, thank you. We have reached the top of the hour. Sean will join me in just a moment. It is 6 o'clock at WSBT.
Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's weekday sports beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good! Villanova Bill wins it.
He dived. It is a touchdown. New England wins.
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row.
Miles Boykin is in the end zone. The Irish have come back.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
Hour number two of Sports Beat for this Tuesday, May the 29th. Sean Stiers from our WSBT studios. I'm Darren Pritchett with the South Bend Cubs. Dow Diamond, Midland, Michigan, home of the Great Lakes Loons, the L.A. Dodgers affiliate. The Loons and the Cubs will have a first pitch tonight of 7:05. The pregame gets underway at 6:50, so we have just about 43 minutes of talk time for hour number two of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, brought to you by Budweiser, Goshen Heart and Vascular, and Blackthorn Golf Club, including the Blackthorn Card. All right, I'm going to mix up the order here since there's been a little update this afternoon of the Anthony Rizzo slide story from the Cubs-Pirates game yesterday. Hey, the Cubs won 7-0. This play doesn't affect the outcome. But it's been an interesting 24 hours following this play, a throw to the plate, and the Pirates catcher Elias Diaz caught the baseball for the force out, took a step in front of the plate to throw to first to try to complete a double play. Anthony Rizzo slid near the catcher. He raised the front leg a little bit and took the legs out from under the catcher, and Diaz's throw to first went sailing over the first base area down the right field line, and that cleared the bases. Pittsburgh asked for a review. Joe Mann went nuts, the Cub manager, saying, why are we reviewing this? Clint Hurdle's upset because he felt like his catcher was taken out illegally. So they go to video replay, and the umpires in the video replay room say that the slide was okay. Well, things have changed since yesterday. A source tells ESPN that Major League Baseball has contacted the Cubs and Pirates already today, and that the on-field umpires and the video crew were both wrong, that Rizzo's slide was illegal, it was interference, and it should have been a double play. Now, here's what Pirates manager Clint Hurdle had to say after the game yesterday. Quote, my position and my question is that, at the end of the day, we put a rule in at home plate to protect the catchers. Everybody is going to see the play and say, this is the play you can make on the catcher on his most vulnerable position. He's completely exposed. He's completely out in front of the plate. He has no defense whatsoever. Anthony Rizzo's comment after the game yesterday, quote, you have to go in and break the double play up. I'm not trying to hurt anyone. Plays like that are scary, but at the same time, you have to play hard, end quote. The catcher Diaz had this to say, quote, in my personal opinion, I don't think it was a good slide. I understand that there's old school baseball, but we're not in old school baseball anymore. There are new rules and things we've submitted to, and even us as catchers have mentally prepared ourselves for, and I don't agree that that's a legal slide, end quote. And Joe Madden went on to say it was a perfect play by Rizzo. Joe, I'm sorry, pal, but you're wrong. That wasn't a legal slide. I thought it was illegal as soon as it happened. And we were at Four Winds Field. There were some Cubs roving instructors around the TV, and we had a big discussion about it. And they felt like it was just like a breaking up of a play at second base. I disagreed because the catcher is coming out in front of the plate, and he is absolutely defenseless. And Rizzo cannot take him out in that particular fashion. So I was shocked that the replay didn't overturn it. I'm not shocked today. Major League Baseball allegedly has told both teams that the umpires got it wrong yesterday. Because here's what it comes down to me, Sean. The catcher is in a defenseless position. 10 years ago, that is a great slide. But the Buster Posey play several years ago when he was taken out at home plate, breaking his leg, cost him a lot of time on the field, changed everything. And by today's standards, that was an illegal slide. I don't think it was a dirty slide, but you don't have to have a dirty slide for it to be an illegal slide. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with that last part. You don't have to have a dirty slide for it to be illegal. And I don't think it was dirty at all. I just... I also don't know what a good baseball slide is anymore, because I agree with Rizzo. He's trying to break up a double play. Are you just – and it, the same type of thing happens at second base, and you see it a lot more at second base, obviously. It's a little bit more infrequent at home plate, because this was a bases-loaded situation. You've got a ground ball. You've got a perfect situation. You come home, the catcher tries to throw to first base. And I just, well, I don't know how vulnerable he is. He's stepping away from the plate. I disagree with what Clint Hurdle said, because he said this is when a catcher is most vulnerable. I disagree with that, because the Buster Posey play, he was actually in front of the plate. I mean, when a catcher is most vulnerable is when, with the old rule, when he was allowed to block the plate, and then you just get completely leveled. Now the catcher has to give that inside lane to the plate. I realize his legs were there, but so is a guy not allowed to make any contact at all anymore to try to break up a double play? I guess that's what I don't get.
See, here's where I think it's different than a play at second base. If a shortstop gets a ground ball, he throws to second. The second baseman makes the catch on the bag, and then normally they take a step one way or the other in order to throw the baseball. The runners have to go straight into the bag now. They cannot chase that fielder. Anthony Rizzo went after the catcher, who was stepping out in front of the plate. So if you look at it from that standpoint, it's just like a second baseman stepping out of the way in order to get the throw off. You can't go after him. And in this spot, the catcher is in front of the plate throwing. He's off the plate. So by rule, Rizzo can't go after him. He's got to just slide directly into home plate.
But he did slide into home. Now, the bulk of his body was to the inside part of the plate, but part of that rule as well is that you have to be able to make contact with the base or the plate or whatever, and Rizzo's arm is coming right to the plate. I mean, Anthony Rizzo is obviously a pretty big guy. I mean,
he is.
So there's a lot to his body, I guess, is what I'm saying. And again, he's not intentionally going out of his way to level the catcher, and he's also not recklessly sliding past the plate. He is still sliding to the plate. His momentum start, and that's part of the rule as well, that you can't slide past the bag or, you know, obviously
correct.
Again, in this case, the plate. So I just, Major League Baseball ruled that by the letter of the law, they should have called it the other way. So I guess I can see that, but again, I don't see any malice in this slide. It's a guy making a baseball play.
Lifted his leg.
Who's trying to? He had his legs up as part of the slide. Again, he's not kicking at him or whipping his legs at him or anything like that.
Sean, I have a still shot of the play. The catcher is 5 feet from home plate when he has not released the baseball, and Rizzo is sliding inside the third base line.
Right.
So he is going out of his way in order to get to the catcher. I mean, if you go to ESPN.com, they have the story, and you can see a video, and they have it just frozen with the throw just about ready to come out of the catcher's hand. He's got it all the way back by his ear. And Rizzo is sliding inside the line, and the catcher's nowhere near home plate. So looking at that still shot, I feel even stronger that it was interference, and I do not like the fact he lifted his leg. That's where the Pirates thought the play was dirty. I don't believe it was dirty. I just don't like him lifting his leg. You just slide into the plate. You don't slide into a base with your foot in the air.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I don't think we're going to agree. I think there has to be – was the catcher hurt by any of this? He wasn't hurt, right?
At the end of the day, no.
Yeah, so that's
– But we can't base it on injury, though.
Well
– Or can we? Go ahead.
But I guess my point is, what's a guy allowed to do on the bases anymore to try to play baseball and help his team? Because to me, that's all Rizzo was doing. Now, again, if you break that down and you look at it frame by frame, you're right. He was to the inside of the plate. But again, it's not like he had to reach far with his arm to make contact with the plate. The bulk of his body was inside, but he had a direct line with his arm to the plate. And it would have been the same if it was at second base. He didn't go egregiously out of his way to try to go inside to make contact with the catcher. He's keeping contact with the plate, which he's supposed to do by a rule, and trying to break up a double play. I think you have to be able to try to break up a double play if you're playing baseball, regardless of if it's at second base, home plate, or wherever it happens to be.
I still think if you see the video and you stop it, and you see how far.
If you see how far
the catcher is away from home plate, he's defenseless, and that's what this is all about. They don't want hits to be taken in position where the defenders are not expecting to be hit. When you take a couple of steps out in front of home plate, you are not expected to be hit. And I think that's where the problem lies right now in this whole conversation. He is in a place on the field where he should not be touched. And if you're not expecting that because of the rules that are in place, and let me say this, I don't necessarily agree with all these rules. It's become flag football. I don't like that. I'm just playing by the rules given to us by Major League Baseball. If he is in position to throw the ball and he's not near home plate, you should not expect to be touched.
Again, I understand what you're saying. But I mean, he had to have his foot on the plate to get the force out to begin
Correct.
With.
Yes.
And so I mean, he makes the catch and he is stepping away from the plate to make that throw. So I mean, just kind of it naturally looks like he was farther away than he was, because in a split second he was on the plate, then he's stepping away to try to make the throw to first. So that's part of why Rizzo was sliding the way he was sliding. I mean, again, I think if you polled, and I haven't seen a poll on this. I wish I had it today, and I kind of looked for some. I think mm-hmm. if you polled people, I think you'd probably get a pretty good split of at best 60-40. I think it's pretty even with the way people saw it. Brian Kenny, I know, he thought originally that essentially, like I think, and now he's kind of changed his tune a little bit since Major League Baseball has come out with this declaration that they called it wrong yesterday. And I completely understand that, because there was contact of the catcher. Mm-hmm. They're trying to protect the catcher and all that. But to me, I just think you've got a Major League Baseball player trying to make a Major League Baseball play and break up a double play and help his team.
And I think Major League Baseball has realized that they want to keep the star players on the field, so they're going
right.
to try to take away some of these hits.
Yeah.
And again, I don't necessarily agree with all these new rules. I know why they're doing it, and I'm just trying to evaluate the situation by these rules that have been put in place, and I just think he was in a vulnerable position. I mean, to me, if it's the 1970s, that is a beautiful play.
Sure.
And that's the shame of it. I mean, in 1970, it's a great play. There's not going to be a brouhaha. There's not going to be pushing and shoving. But in today's game, I mean, it's just a different environment by the rules being created by Major League Baseball, and they just don't want those big collisions anymore. Everything in sports is about no collisions. I mean, you can't do anything about it in hockey. In football, they're trying to take away these... I mean, offensive linemen can't lower their heads now, for crying out loud. I don't know how they're going to play football. And now baseball is just really trying to clean up all these possible hits that could take people out of action.
Yep, I agree.
Strange.
I agree.
Very strange. All right, well, we'll just disagree on that one, and I'm sure this will be brought up again sometime soon. We'll have another play like this. I don't think we've had one at home plate in a while, so that kind of brought up the discussion once again. Indy 500 yesterday, Will Power. I'm sorry, it was Sunday, excuse me. We're off. At least we had a short show yesterday due to the South Bend Cubs game. So we talked about this for a couple of seconds. But the 500 won by Will Power, took the lead with four laps to go. And the amazing part of the whole thing, Roger Penske winning his 17th 500 as a car owner. And I did not enjoy the 500 this year. As someone that we talked about this, I think, on Friday,
right.
that enjoys the 500. 2 years ago, we had 54 changes of the lead. There were slingshots. There was a lot of excitement. This was a very dull race. The cars were not set up for all the slingshots. In fact, the driver said it was one of the more difficult setups that the Indy Racing League had given them for an Indy 500. So I was disappointed. There was not as much action as there was 2 years ago. 2 years ago was unbelievable. I mean, guys were taking runs and there were passes. It was fantastic. Maybe I got spoiled from 2 years ago, but it was fun watching it. But it wasn't like, wow, there's going to be a lot of memorable moments from that Indy 500.
Unfortunately, I didn't watch any of it. So I
know you did.
I'm sorry.
I know you didn't. But I actually watched. My son wanted to watch Rockets Warriors last night, and of course I'm a hockey guy, so I gave in. We kind of flipped back and forth in commercials and at halftime. But what a turnaround again. Second straight game in that Western Conference Final. Houston is up double digits. And the third quarter, the Warriors come roaring back, and they take Game 7 to get to the NBA Finals once again, a 101-92 victory. It was stunning to watch the Rockets, let alone any professional basketball team, have the inability to make a three-point shot. Amazing. I mean, they were 0 for 20-something at one point. They couldn't buy anything. I thought their shot selection in the third quarter, they were playing a lot of hero basketball. Everybody was just trying to make the big play. I felt like that's the way Golden State played kind of in the first half, and the roles changed again in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, I think Houston is still missing three-pointers right now. They missed
unbelievable
37, and I guess they asked Mike D'Antoni after the game if he thought about telling his team, you know, hey, you might want to think about another kind of shot and not take the threes, but
right.
He kind of laughed at the media because that's their game. They take those threes, and they just, without Chris Paul especially, you know, they weren't a team. Golden State could take a hit, even though they paid the price in the short term when they lost Andre Iguodala for games 5 and 6. But Houston, just the way their roster is built, they couldn't afford to lose Chris Paul in the depth. You could tell their legs were tired. They had too many guys out there trying to play too many minutes, and 37 missed three-pointers. It was amazing. I didn't even realize it at the time, and I was watching with my son. He's like, they've missed 27 in a row. And I'm like, hold it, what? Because, you know, you knew that they had missed a few, but 27 in a row, they just kept missing and missing it. And it's their combination of missing those and again, with their lack of depth, Golden State just seemed to get more and more energy through the second half. They almost looked bored in the first half. But Houston kind of spent itself in the first half with what they were doing, and they just had nothing by the time the fourth quarter came around.
Four straight year, we've had Golden State versus Cleveland in the finals, first time in major American sports history. We've had the same matchup in the finals four straight years. And I saw in Las Vegas today, if you put down $1,100 on Golden State, you win 100 back. That just shows you how big a favorite Golden State is. Amazing. Against Cleveland. The Warriors have LeBron, but you just wonder. They're not in the East anymore. The East has not been overly great the last few years, and that's no disrespect to LeBron and the Cavaliers. But now you run into the Warriors, and it just doesn't feel like Cleveland would have enough to get it done with just LeBron and his supporting cast. You kind of feel like this might be the end of the road for them.
You would think so. Just getting here, I think, has been a major accomplishment for LeBron. To me, it's like, can they at least make it a six-game series? That might be the biggest question of this whole thing. But who knows? I think we've kind of been surprised a little bit that Golden State was pushed to the limit the way they were, and two, that LeBron was able to kind of find his second wind and get Cleveland this far. So who knows? Maybe it'll turn out to be entertaining. It was a 4-1 win for Golden State last year, though, and I think, I mean, the fact that you would only win $100 by dropping over $1,000 as a bet, I mean, that tells you right there what this series should be. It shouldn't be much of a series, but crazier things have happened, and I'm sure LeBron's going to find some energy to take over at least one game of this series.
First time in 40 years with two Game 7s in the NBA, and the road team wins both.
Yeah.
All right, we did this in the first hour. Let me give you your shot to answer these questions, Sean. We're talking about first memories of sports. First event you remember seeing in person.
I didn't go to a lot of sporting events when I was a kid. I lived in the middle of Kansas, Manhattan, Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State University is. Not my alma mater, the University of Kansas, but I actually lived where Kansas State is. The first game I remember going to in person was a KUK State, Kansas versus Kansas State, I believe 1978. It was back, it was a football game. Neither team was good.
Ooh.
They referred to it as the toilet bowl back then.
Oh, no.
A friend of mine and I, we snuck in. That's how hard it was to get into a KUK State game, but that was it. And somewhere around there, we also started, we'd go to a Royals game or two a year, but the KUK State football game in the late 70s was the first one I remember.
First event you remember watching on TV?
I don't remember a lot of details about it, but it would have been early 70s Monday night football game. I do remember the Washington Redskins being on. That's my dad's team, actually. So that's I remember that. Redskins Monday night football.
Dad a Redskin fan, son a Cowboy fan. That's an interesting combination.
Funny how that worked, huh?
And finally, was there an event that maybe for the first time a sporting event was very impactful on you?
I think the biggest one I remember would have been Super Bowl 13, Cowboys-Steelers. Pittsburgh ended up winning by 4. Roger Staubach had 3 touchdown passes in that game, 2 in the fourth quarter. But the moment that shook me forever was the one that wasn't a touchdown. Jackie Smith, a career St. Louis Cardinal tight end, dropped what should have been potentially the game winner in the end zone. Dallas lost, and I've been anti-Steeler ever since.
I think the announcer said, bless his heart, after he dropped the ball.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was Vern Lundquist.
Vern Lundquist. Yep. You're exactly right. That was tough to watch.
Yep.
Probably Jackie got taken off the hook when Scott Norwood missed the field goal for the Bills in the Super Bowl against the Giants, although wasn't it 47 yards? It's like it wasn't a chip shot, but unfortunately we all remember Scott Norwood.
And Jackie Smith, again, he was a career St. Louis Cardinal. That was his only season with Dallas. They still had Billy Joe Dupree at that time, who was kind of the first of the great Cowboy tight ends. But Jackie, I mean, he had a Hall of Fame career, but he's most remembered, I think, for that moment in that Super Bowl with the Cowboys.
Without a doubt, very unfortunate. All right, we've got rapid fire coming up next. The Sports Beat continues, 628 at WSBT. Darren Pritchett, Sean Steyer's with you on this Tuesday evening, and now Sean takes over the program as he hosts another installment of Rapid Fire.
Let's do a fill in the blank on this first one, Darren. 95 days until the start of the Notre Dame football season. So, with number 95, Myron Tagovailoa-Amosa, in mind, your expectations for the defensive lineman this season are blank.
Oh, boy. I guess I would just say I would hope he would be a player that could contribute. Let me throw out 25 to 30 quality snaps that would put him in the classification of being a winning football player.
That sounds like a pretty solid expectation. I mean, that's when you look at what he was last year. He played in all 13 games, rotated part of that rotation on the defensive line where they rotated 8 guys, and he didn't have quite as many snaps as the guys starting, but he finished with 12 tackles,
right?
1.5 tackles for loss, so solid for the time he was in there. Provided good depth, and I think that's kind of what I look for from him this year. Just keep providing good depth. He's going to be behind Jerry Tillery, who we all expect a lot from this year, and so his contribution, I think, is that there's not a drop-off when Jerry Tillery needs to get a break, and he's out there, and just kind of keep putting up good consistency, improve this year so that when next year rolls around and Jerry Tillery's gone, he's ready to move into that spot. Just be a solid contributor and keep providing good depth like he did last year, I think.
And everybody knows when we say we don't want Amosa to have to play a lot because you want Tillery on the field. That's an All-American candidate, maybe a second-round pick in next year's NFL draft that would be taken off the field. So his time's coming. I just hope the major snaps come in 2 years.
Yep, that's right. Okay, which Cubs pitcher are you more confident will turn his season around, Yu Darvish or Tyler Chatwood?
Gosh.
Now, the key word is more confident, not completely confident, just more confident.
You know, I'm going to say Chatwood. The main reason is health. Darvish has had the flu, and we've had other ailments. Chatwood's healthy. He's just not throwing strikes.
True.
Jim Hickey's an outstanding pitching coach, so I feel like that's someone that can help Chatwood. Again, I fell into the classification you asked the question earlier this year on Rapid Fire, who would you rather have, Darvish or Arrieta? And I said neither. Now, Arrieta has turned out to be the right answer so far.
Right.
I just don't like those 30-year-old free agent pitchers.
Agree.
But Darvish has been very hittable. He has been unable to get through five innings in a majority of his starts. The injuries are piling up, so I feel like the definitive answer is Chatwood right now. If he could just throw more strikes, he could be well above average for this team. It's not like he's been hit extremely hard. The last start he got hit a little bit, but walks have been the major problem for him.
That has been the major problem. That is the big thing. Five walks in just 2 2/3 in his last start against the Giants. His 10 starts, he's averaged just a little under five innings per start. He's walking about 4.5 guys per start as well, almost a walk per inning, which is drastically up from his career. He hasn't been this kind of guy. He's got to get his mechanics figured out. That's the big thing. I guess the question is, how much longer does he have to kind of get it figured out? See, I go back. You're right about Darvish. His is an injury, and he's on the DL right now with triceps tendonitis. But his issue hasn't been mechanical. I think it's just about making better pitches in some good situations and just finding some level of comfort out there. So I feel like if Darvish's injury isn't serious, right, I think he's got the better chance of being able to turn things around, because Chatwood just looks like a mess right now when you can't even find the strike zone.
I like it. We're just going to disagree on everything today.
It sounds like it. There's nothing wrong with that.
Sky isn't blue. What are you talking about?
Everything. We're just in one of those. We're in one of those spells where we've got different points of view.
I thought you were going to say we're just one of those points where I'm always wrong and you're right now.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that at all, because the other side of it is sometimes I feel like I'm always wrong and you're always right. So we're both just spinning right now.
I'm sure most listeners think the same way.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm kidding.
You may be right.
I'm sorry. I'm kidding.
All right. Interesting one here. This came out over the weekend. Major League Baseball attendance is currently at a 15-year low through this point in the season. And a lot of different theories being kind of tossed out there. Some people think it has to do with all the strikeouts, more strikeouts than hits in the month of April, bad weather to start the season. So do you think it's one of those two things that's maybe the main culprit or something else?
As you were reading the question, three things came to mind.
Okay.
Number one, it was a horrible weather month in April. That's got to be a factor. That's not all 15%, though. Number two, with technology, it is very enjoyable to watch a baseball game on a high-definition TV. You got the strike zone boxes on most of the games.
Yeah.
You got all the replays. So the product has gotten so much better. So that's a positive. And I'll just use myself as an example, who is a huge baseball fan. I was looking at a couple of dates to possibly go to a game coming up over the next couple of months. And just looking at the box seat lower level area of the game I was looking at over several days, the cost has just gotten ridiculous.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And I know they're corporate seats now. I get it. They wouldn't put the price tag on the tickets if they could not get people to buy them. But, I mean, a family of four, you're probably at least, what, $200 in the hole before you even park your car, and that's probably $10 or $20. So the cost is getting way up there. There needs to be more opportunities to get families into the ballpark. Now school's going to get out, so that's going to help attendance. But I just think the quality of the TV product, the bad weather, and I think ticket prices are getting to that point now where it's costing them some folks coming out to the ballpark in certain cities.
Yeah, I think price has always been a big thing, and it always has been and always will be. Some interesting numbers that I saw from the story that I read today. Miami, what would you expect? But they're averaging only a little over 10,000
right
per game. But, I mean, they're one of these teams that's on pace to lose 100 games, so you would expect it there. The Orioles, Tigers, and Royals all have averages a little over 19,000. Tigers a little bit surprising. I mean, they're in second place. They're not doing bad. Kansas City was selling out just 2 years ago. So, I mean, you think about that. They had a huge surge. Mm. They went for like 2 years where they're selling out all the time. Now they're back down to around 19,000 again. But, again, they're losing. Here's what I don't get, though. Here are two teams I completely don't understand their attendance right now. Cleveland, averaging around 17,000 a game. They've been a playoff team for 2+ years. They're in first place right now. They're down 3,000 a game from last year. Pittsburgh, contending in the NL Central, but they're only averaging a little over 16,000. And did you see the game yesterday on TV at all?
Yes.
It's Memorial Day. The outfield is almost completely empty. It looked like they had right around 16,000. Oh. How do you get 16,000 for a contending team with the Cubs in on Memorial Day? I'm shocked.
That's the sign of a fan base that is ticked off that they traded Andrew McCutchen and Garrett Cole. And you know what? I don't blame them. I don't blame them.
The lack of stars doesn't help you, that's for sure.
There was a window yet for that team, and they started to tear it apart. And, yeah, they're overachieving right now. I think everything will balance out, and they'll be, I still think, a below 500 baseball team by the end of the year. The best way to show your frustration for moves by an organization is not to show up. And the Pirates fans have decided to go that route. That's their route. I mean, they support their Steelers, they support their Penguins, and they go all out to win every single year. And you know what? I think that hurts the Pirates because they're the one team in town that does not go all out. They make themselves a small market team. Sean, the last couple of years, remember the crowds they had in Pittsburgh when they had quality teams, when they were making the wild card?
Just like Kansas City, yeah.
So that shows you, you put in the product, fans are going to show up in Pittsburgh, but their Steelers and their Penguins do whatever it takes for them to win. The Pirates don't do it, and I think Pittsburgh, the fans see that, and they're not going to go out and support the Pirates unless they get full effort from the organization.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the price is a big thing, and there are a lot of different places that have tried to do more as far as family seating, and you know, you get your kind of bundle where you get your ticket. You get like four hot dogs, four sodas for a decent price and things like that. There are different places that are trying to do things, but price is always a big thing. And I wonder, because we've talked before about the demographics for baseball. The median age is around 54, 55. And I just wonder with technology and the whole thing and the fact that baseball hasn't done a better job of marketing to a younger audience, if that is starting to kind of creep in there as well, you know, where you just aren't getting that mid-20s, early 30s, mid-30s kind of fan right now.
If I could just jump in for a second, one thing that I did notice, and I apologize, I'm bringing up my team again, but one thing they did at Busch Stadium this year in the upper deck down the right field line, the last section, they tore out the seats and they made it a party area with stand-up tables. It's kind of a social area. It's about the game, but at the same time, people go there to socialize. There's different foods out there, and it's more of a stand-around like at a bar atmosphere, and that has brought a lot of the younger generation to that part of the ballpark and getting them into the ballpark, as a matter of fact.
It's a good idea. Great idea. Heck, in Philly, they did Bark at the Park. Did you see Jay Wright with his dog at the game the other day in Philadelphia?
I did not.
Yeah, the Villanova head coach had his dog out there, and the cameras found him out there.
Very cool.
In the crowd. Yep, good stuff. Okay, last question for you tonight. Do you buy or sell LeBron versus Golden State for the fourth straight year being good for the NBA?
Boy, this has been debated all day on the national circuit. I've heard a lot of good arguments. I think if Cleveland was a better team than the last 2 years, I would say yes. But I don't think the Cleveland roster is as good as when they won it 2 years ago or lost last year. So I think it loses some of its steam. Hey, let's face it. Getting to a final four straight years in any sport is an unbelievable accomplishment. Look at the Buffalo Bills in the early 90s going to four Super Bowls. Even though they didn't win one, that's a heck of an accomplishment. So it is an accomplishment, but I don't know if it's the best for the NBA because I don't think we have two rosters that line up in equal fashion. I mean, the finals seem to be Houston and Golden State, and if some people ever get their way that you rank the playoff teams, regardless of conference, 1 yeah. through 16, you would have had Golden State and Houston maybe in the finals, and that would have been your Game 7 last night.
Could LeBron potentially beat Houston if that was a series, say, in the semifinals this round? That would be interesting in itself. A lot of different combinations then if yeah. they did have it seeded differently so it didn't matter which conference you were from. I mean, I don't think that it's great, and I think there is some probably fatigue, especially when you get down around Los Angeles where the Lakers stink right now and some of these other big markets who just don't care. I don't think anyone in the East cares much for LeBron, and that's understandable because he's now in his eighth finals in a row between Cleveland and Miami, and obviously Golden State, I mean, nobody's pulling for them in the West, outside of the Bay Area, Northern California. But I do think that there is some value in having the best player in the game, LeBron James, being back in the finals. So you've got the best player and the best team for a fourth year in a row. I don't know that it's great, but at the very least, you have three of the game's biggest stars with LeBron, Kevin Durant, and Steph Curry mm-hmm. all being in there. So I don't think that it's necessary. I don't know that it's great big picture, but I don't think it's bad when you've got three big stars like that playing in the finals again.
It's great points. And I think this series would be more anticipated if they would have played a seven-game epic series last year,
right,
and then maybe Cleveland goes and gets a Kyrie Irving to add to their group to try to get them over the hump after losing last year.
Yeah.
That would have really revved it up, but this just appears to be a series. Golden State beat them last year. Cleveland's not as good, so Golden State's going to beat them again.
I think how it's going to go.
Yeah, the Stanley Cup Final, I mean, Washington and Vegas is not very sexy.
Right.
For a lot of the big markets. So I expect the ratings not to be very good, even though Vegas is a cool story and Ovechkin plays for the Capitals. I do not expect this to be a big ratings gatherer for the NHL. So the NBA has the advantage there with their matchup.
Would have to think so.
All right, there you go. Good stuff today on Rapid Fire. Sean and Darren with you. Sports be brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds by Goshen Heart and Vascular. Be the hero your heart deserves. Visit GoshenHeartAndVascular.org. And Blackthorn Golf Club, featuring the Blackthorn card, just $99 at Blackthorn, and you can save up to 80% of rounds of golf at Blackthorn with the Blackthorn card that comes with great specials at the Blarney Hole as well. Well, that's going to do it for Sports Beat tonight. We've got Cub baseball coming up in a couple of moments. Sean, thank you. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Cubs and Loons coming up in just a moment on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.